Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, August 30th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And I want to first and foremost apologize for not having a new episode for you last week. I have worked very hard over the past, what is it now, 7 years to bring you a brand new show every single week. I take 2 weeks off over the holidays in like late December, early January, but that's it. Otherwise, I do 50 shows a year. This is the first time in a really long time that I've had to just skip a week. And part of it is because I'm working on my dissertation right now. I'm seeing patients as part of my practicum training for my PhD. I'm also doing a live daily television show, and I work on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and sometimes also on God Awful Movies. And yeah, so we have this production calendar and it's smooth sailing, but every so often, if there has to be a change to the scheduling, we work really hard. I want to give a massive shout out to Noelle Dilworth, my assistant, because she's incredible. But every so often, we just can't accommodate. And instead of literally killing myself trying to make it work, I decided to take a mental health week. Now, that's not to say that I didn't do all those other things last week, but I didn't also, you know, just brutalize myself by trying to fit in a podcast that wasn't slated anyway, and we couldn't get our guests to shift around their schedule. So we skipped last week. That's okay. And don't worry, those of you who support the show via Patreon, you obviously weren't charged for the episode because we didn't post a new episode, so there's nothing to charge you for. That has picked back up this week with our newest episode. And on that note, I do want to thank those of you who support the show via Patreon. I really couldn't do this without you. So if you don't know, patreon.com, it's a website where individuals can pledge their support. They can be patrons of the arts, and they can pick on an episodic basis to support the shows that they know and love. And you can, you know, support as little as like a dollar an episode, 50 cents an episode even. I've been thinking a lot about how I can up the ante. I'd love to hear back from you guys either through the Patreon a message portal or through social media. What is it that you're looking for as my patrons? You know, so far this has been a very like honor system. Thank you so much. And I'm just going to crank these out and do what I'm doing. But I'd like to give back in a way that is meaningful, but that's also manageable. Maybe doing an ad-free version of the podcast for you, something of that nature. So I'd love to hear what it is that you guys are looking for and what you think a fair pledge would be for that. Each week I do give shout outs to my highest pledging individuals, and they're awesome. I'm talking like $50 an episode, $25 an episode. Like, God, you guys, you're incredible. So big thanks this week to Daniel Lang, to Mary Neva, to Rob Schreck, to Pasquale Gelati, to Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, David J. E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, and Ulrika Hagman. Oh, and also Robert Chris. Thank you all so much. You guys are just incredible, and you really do warm my heart. And you make it possible, once again, for everybody who can't afford to listen to the show if it were behind a paywall or something like that. Like, I don't want to do that to anybody. So you make it possible for everybody else to be able to listen to the show for free. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And of course, to the hundreds of others who support the show at various amounts. If you want to support the show, just visit patreon.com/talknerdy. All right, enough business at the top. I am so excited to talk to you about this week's episode. So I had the opportunity to sit down with, with an incredible individual. His name is Dr. Hakeem Olusheyi, and he is a physicist who's held a lot of really cool positions. I wanted to like pull up right here so you could hear all of the cool things that he's done. Yeah, he was a distinguished professor of aerospace, physics, and space sciences at the Florida Institute of Technology from 2007 to 2019. He's held professorships at MIT, at the University of California at Berkeley, at the University of Washington, at the University of Cape Town. He has served as the Space Science Education Manager of the Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington. He's been the Chief Science Officer of Discovery Science and also the President of the National Society of Black Physicists. And of course, he's appeared on a ton of different media outlets, Netflix, Discovery Science, Nat Geo, PBS, BBC, and so many more. And of course, also multiple honorees. So he's an inductee of the National Academy of Inventors, the National Black College Alumni Hall of Fame, and the Sigma Pi Sigma Physics Honor Society. And he has a new book, and the new book is amazing because it's a memoir and it talks about his story, his journey, and you know, the things that he has accomplished in his life, also the struggles that he has faced. It's really inspirational. I think it's a really important story. And so here it is. It's A Quantum Life, My Unlikely Journey from the Streets to the Stars. So without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Hakeem Olusheyi. Well, Hakeem, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I when your book first came across my desk, I was really thrilled, and I immediately reached out to the publicist. That's how it usually works, from the publisher, the publicist from the publisher, and said, "Please, please, please, can we get him on my show? Because I think that." I'm just really excited to talk about this story. Today it's going to be physics, but also life, physics and social justice, physics and race and class and socioeconomic status. But all of that is to say physics and you, because this is a story that's not just about your work as a professor, your work as a scientist, I should say, but your life and how you got where you are today, but how who you are is always going to be rooted in, you know, the kind of context of some of the problems here in America.
Absolutely. And, you know, I wrote my book because people asked for it. And so I felt that I had to be just completely upfront and honest and let people see that you don't have to be you know, necessarily some kind of raving genius or super rich to, you know, go to college and become a scientist, right? So, even someone as jacked up as me can do it.
And so I think, you know, that opens up a kind of an important question right here at the top before we kind of get into the narrative of your story, sort of the autobiography portion of this, which is that anybody can do it. But it's a hell of a lot easier for some people, isn't that true?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, I say that to inspire those who think, hey, maybe this isn't for me. You know, it is for you. And of course, it is easier for some. We'll get into that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's always the frustration, I think, when it comes to science communication in general. And I know I'm going off on a massive tangent right at the top of the show, but I remember years ago having a woman on the show. I think her name was Jo Ruxton. She's a British documentary filmmaker. And she had worked on Blue Planet, you know, this like stunning, kind of very visual, storytelling about our oceans. And she was proud of the work she had done, but she also felt very guilty and ultimately ended up making another movie right after called A Plastic Ocean, because she said, I think it's important to do this stuff that's inspirational and aspirational and to really tell people what could be. But I also think it's important to be real and say, but this is how it is right now. And as much as, you know, I think I want young kids to see representation and I want them to know, like, you can do this. It's not just an old white man's club. At the same time, you're going to be putting up with some shit. It's not going to be as easy for you.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, well, you know, that's life here in the U.S., right? You know, because we have what every society has, and that is identity hierarchies. And here in America, right, they center around race and sex and gender and you know, economics, these sort of things, just like they do everywhere else. But we don't get to choose where we're born, at what time we're born, right? And so we have to, you know, pursue life regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a very sort of existential. So I'm working on my PhD in existential psychology right now. I do therapy in sort of like end of life and oncology stuff. And yeah, I'm very existentially oriented. And you just said something that's very existential, which is like none of us negotiated this up front. We just dealt with the hand, you know, we were dealt a hand, and then we have to make sense of it and make meaning from it. And you, of course, have done just that. You have held professorships kind of all over the world and have worked in a lot of different, very important, both kind of practical and also, I guess we could say, more theoretical areas. I'm interested in sort of, we'll go back soon, but where you're at now in terms of, you know, you're a physicist, a cosmologist, but you've also done a lot of kind of public communication of science. And where do you see yourself, you know, kind of in this weird COVID world and with regards to like where you're putting most of your energy and attention right now?
Yeah. So I have to compartmentalize to some degree. I had the good fortune or the misfortune to read a article in a paper when I was in grad school. And it was actually a quote from Condoleezza Rice. And what she said was that the joy of being an academic researcher is that you get to follow your curiosity. So I've taken that way too seriously. And so, you know, I get bored easily too, right? So I jump from area to area. So, and then, you know, I try my hand at new things. So if you look over the last 5 years of my career, you know, I've been the chief science officer for Discovery, the space science education manager at NASA headquarters, you know, an administrative position. And, you know, I've done a lot of television and I've not been in a classroom at all. Right. And so now, even in, for the year 2020, you know, I spent that year and half and most of 2019 writing the book. Right. So, you know, now I'm about to hopefully make a movie and do a podcast of my own and, you know, do other things. And I just started a new professorship at George Mason University. So,
oh, very cool. I love that. And so when you do your professoring, what kind of science, I always like to ask this of, especially of cosmologists, like, what does your quote lab look like? Is it a whiteboard? Is it computers? Is it, you know, like, how are you doing your science?
So let me tell you the description of my last lab.
Okay.
I switched between highly computational work and laboratory work, right? Building instruments, detectors, that sort of thing. So my last research group, I actually had two research groups. One was doing what we call near field cosmology or galactic archaeology. And basically the idea is we find stars for whom they have a special characteristic, which means we know how bright they are. These are different types of pulsating variable stars. And because we know how bright they are, based on how bright they appear, we can tell how far away they are. All right. And so once you do that for many, many stars, you can map them out in 3D space and sort of identify and disentangle the various substructures that came together to form our galaxy. And if you understand how our galaxy formed, that informs you on how other galaxies may have formed and tells you something about how the universe evolved. So that was one side. The other side was my plasma physics group. So our laboratory is the surface of the sun. So we publish a lot of solar physics papers, but also I would tell my students to pay attention to phenomena that is what we call scale invariant. That means that, you know, it's some phenomenon and we're looking at it in stars and it may happen on the scale of millions of miles in stars, but it can happen on any scale. And so one of my graduate students identified such a process that accelerates ions in the solar atmosphere. And so we spun off of an experimental group that is doing ion propulsion based on this new technology. So we published the first paper on it in 2017, and now it's about building the prototype.
Wow. So studying a phenomenon that occurs naturally within kind of the furnace of the sun and then saying, wait, we can maybe take that and utilize the science, utilize the physics and the chemistry that we've learned from it and actually then apply that to something that we can use here on planet Earth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's part of why, you know, I call my work hacking the stars, you know, and I'm using the phrase hack in two ways, right? One is to repurpose. So, you know, I learned this stuff from studying the sun, but now let's use it for this technology. And this is something I did immediately out of graduate school. I have several patents in, you know, manufacturing computer chips where I took a astrophysical technique and applied it to semiconductor manufacturing, right?
Wow.
Yeah. And so
I like how you said that as like a quick aside. Like, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's like I've been doing it for a while. It's just like a cool thing I did in grad school.
Yeah, it's the thing we do, right? Awesome. But yeah, so that's kind of, you know, more of the same. But I have new questions that interest me, right? And so, you know, whatever I did in the past doesn't really matter now. It's about addressing the new questions.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's the coolest thing about, or at least I personally believe that's the coolest thing about science, is that you literally never run out of questions.
Yeah. I love that. And I love the fact that, you know, our workforce are our students. And, you know, these are people that are themselves striving for a better life, right? They, you know, and you know, working with students and helping them, you know, in addition to studying the physical universe, is just like a wonderful combination for life fulfillment for a nerd like me.
Well, and I think that kind of shows that you're more than obviously a scientist, more than even a professor, but that there's a mentorship component to the relationship that you develop with your students. And I sometimes really do struggle, or I don't know if struggle is the right word, but I question or I wonder about it's so necessary that somebody has life experience. And I'm not saying that somebody has to have been through the shit for them to be a good mentor, right? But like, for somebody to have lived a little bit, to know how to be there for a student who themselves is living, I think is such an important thing, especially I'd say right now more than ever, because obviously kids or young adults who maybe don't come from privilege, and even those who do, but especially those who don't, are feeling the weight of the world on their shoulders right now. And I can imagine that you even started to see that, and will be seeing it with your new position.
Newsflash, they've been feeling it their whole lives.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, so someone asked me in a different interview about, you know, some of my criminal activity, right, in the past. And they asked me if it was, you know, why did I do it? Did I have fear or something like that? And, you know, I explained, I was like, what's the difference between doing the crime and how you live your normal life? You're avoiding the police anyway, right? Even if you've done nothing wrong, you know, you still avoid them because you can, you know, you will still fall. Anything could happen. Let's just put it that way, right?
For anything sure. It doesn't matter if you've done, quote, something wrong. If you have a certain color of skin in this country, there's going to be an assumption that you're guilty until proven innocent anyway.
You know, let me rephrase that because, you know, it's not my skin that's the problem, right? I'm Black when I encounter people that are kind and polite and respectful. Right?
Yeah.
So it's not being Black in America that's the problem. It's being around people that discriminate. It's being around.
Exactly. Yes. It's the racism towards the Black skin.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I don't even know if it, I just want to give it all on the person doing bad. That's not even mentioning my skin, right? Because it's all inside of them, right? That's what we know about human beings. When they mistreat others, you know, typically it's about what's inside of themselves.
Yeah. And, you know, and sometimes these, I mean, I don't know, I'm coming at this always from kind of a psychological perspective, because that's where my head has been in the last several years. And I came from neuroscience and then I moved into psychology, and it's been a big perspective shift for me doing that, going from like a much more kind of straight logical, positivistic, like super, super scientific and organic and brain approach to then really opening up to social issues, to normativity, to ethnocentrism, to just the kind of long, long history in this country of power,
right?
Power dynamics. I guess that's a good way to put it, although it's so much more complicated than that. And, you know, when you were born into a system that had been perpetuated long before, you know, we talked about, you had no choice. None of us have a choice in the matter when we're born. And it really is in many ways a roll of the dice. You were born into a system that was a product of iteration and perpetuation for hundreds of years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you know, the thing about my life is that, you know, as you see in the book, I lived in different communities, and so it manifests itself differently, right? So in New Orleans, the culture is somewhat different than in South Central Los Angeles, than in Houston, than in Mississippi, right? These were the communities of my childhood. And so you know, it's really interesting how different things manifest differently in different places, right? So whereas, you know, race was a giant issue in Mississippi and New Orleans, it wasn't as big of an issue on the West Coast, right? And, you know, at the same time, if you look at the African-American community in the Deep South, they had, like, you know, when I was a child, their own economy, right? So there was a lot of land ownership, a lot of businesses that were owned by people. Even though, you know, if you gave a glance, you'd say, oh, the people in the Deep South are way worse off, right? But, you know, it's weird. You know, everything, I feel like when we have these public discussions, there's a lot of, like, absolutes and binary.
Yeah, yeah.
But things are very gray, you know, and there's a variation in any, you know, in everything, right? There's a, you know, there are no delta functions in nature. All right, that was a nerdy term. For those of you who feel that.
yeah.
Delta function. It only has one value. That's the thing about it, right?
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Yeah, it is very, and I think that's always the part that I try to grapple with here on the show. It's part of why I like to do a long form show, is because the gray, the nuance, the context, that's the stuff of life, right? It's not always clean. And I think we can hypothesis test, and we can make statements about the world. But as I always used to tell my students when I was teaching, generally speaking, if a test is a true, if there's a true false question and there's the word always in it, blah, 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 always, well, it's probably false.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Always, never, you know, those types of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's some things that you can say that about, but not many of them in the real world.
Exactly. And so, you know, and I think it's also kind of an interesting parallel, of course, between working in a field that has, I mean, I guess the takeaway here is this idea that life is quantum. It's not sort of this very Newtonian, law-based, rule-based function.
Right. Yeah, it's probabilistic is what it is. So, you know, in a deterministic physics, the initial conditions determine the trajectory and the final outcome. But in quantum mechanics, the conditions only determine the probability of particular outcomes. And so, you know, there's even cases where outcomes that seem impossible occur in the quantum realm. For example, quantum tunneling, right? You know, you made it beyond a barrier that you were not supposed to make it beyond. And that's what you can do in real life. But, you know, if you want to become a scientist, you know, the foundations of that are logic and mathematics, right? And I personally feel, based on all my experience, that if you're well educated in those two, it's because either you have parents, family, community that are, or you're just incredibly lucky.
Right. And I think there's this refreshing view that I would love to see adopted more readily in American culture, which is that not everything is a function of how hard I worked. Not everything is a function of, you know, how much I had volition and internal strength of will. And I think it's an important story, but it's often taken to such an extreme that we forget about all the other variables, which are that some people work harder than anyone else in their life and they still can't catch a break.
Well, look, I've lived at a lot of different socioeconomic levels, right? Ones I haven't lived at are the ones at the top. But, you know, you get to a certain level and I've lived in everyone down from there. And this reminds me of when I stepped foot on Stanford's campus, right? After spending the previous decade in Mississippi, you know, after being there for a couple of weeks, I looked at the people around me and I said, listen, you know, these people are not intrinsically smarter than the people from in the communities where I grew up in South Central, New Orleans East and Houston's Third Ward, rural Mississippi. And, you know, if you see how I phrase that, you know, there's a little doubt in there. They're not intrinsically smarter, right? They might be, might not be, but they really aren't. You know, it's just a distribution, just like everywhere else. But there was one thing that was pretty obvious. And that the second statement I would say is, They're not intrinsically smarter, and they're damn sure not harder working.
Right.
Right. And right. The people that I see that are living for free are the ones that have someone in the house who can pay for everything. Right. And those aren't poor people, you know. And if you go to any poor community in the morning, you see a mass exodus of people getting on the city bus. Right. To go work for something that barely meets their needs, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, for in politics, people have a way of saying, oh, you know, it's their own fault. Trust me, it's not. Another reason why I wrote the book is to show also the people around me and how brilliant they were, you know. And I just happened to be the nerd who was interested in this stuff, despite it not being present in my community at all. So I feel like there's a huge waste of human potential. I just feel compelled to do something about it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a massive well of like untapped resources because we as a community, we as a society aren't reaching out to areas where we've never given people a chance, basically.
Yeah, and in addition to that, you know, identities are established. And so, you know, if I look at my story, you know, I acted out what I thought I was supposed to be. Right. Young black man. Okay. I got to be intimidating. I got to be a great athlete. I got to be smooth and cool and, you know, all these sort of things. Right. You know, I got to. And so you act these things out. You see young women doing the exact same thing. Right. When it comes to choosing careers. So, you know, that framing of identity, that hierarchy, you know, we all learn it. It's all embedded in all.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. If I say to any person, black, white, Asian, whatever, hey, you know, these people who did eugenics, they ranked the races. And I could give you any races and say you ask you, how do they rank these people? Who's the highest? Who's the lowest? And just about everybody would know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And it's not because it's because it's in our minds. Right. And so, you know, it's kind of like this joke from Chris Rock. You know, he said, who's more racist, black folks or white folks? And the answer was black folks, because we hate N-words, too. Right. And so he was drawing a distinction between, you know, two different types of behavior in the black community. But, you know, the we all learn this hierarchy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so like, we think about race, we think about sex, we think about gender, we think about all these things, and it's internalized. It's so like, that's such an important point, right? Like, as a woman, I have internalized sexist ideas because they're so ingrained culturally that I find myself having to recognize and go, wait a minute, that is a patriarchal thought I just had. Like, that's not me. That's just how I was raised. And I have to kind of actively work against that in order to kind of free myself from it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You have to be mindful and take active measures, you know, so you're not oppressing yourself.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's what ends up happening is that the same seats the seats are filled by the same people at the table over and over and over. A, because those people are actively working as a structure to maintain that kind of power and control. But B, because and I think what ends up happening is that there's a comfortable narrative. I see this with my father a lot. I was raised in the South as well. I was raised in Texas. And I see this with my father a lot, who's quite conservative. And he will say things like, you know, he does that very classic, that ultra disgusting thing about like helping people help themselves.
Right. Yeah.
Like, he loves that kind of narrative because he sees himself as quite, I see him as a bit of a white savior. He sees himself as quite, community oriented, and, you know, because he's quite religious and he's like, you know, does a lot of charity work. And but there's like a weird twist on it always of like, oh, these people just don't know how, or these people aren't willing to try hard enough. And it's like, no, these people, it's like they don't, if they would just drink, it's like, yeah, but you're keeping them from the water hole.
Right. And here's another question for you. Think about it like this. Between a grandparent's birth and the grandchild's death, how many years is that?
Oh, gosh.
Right. We're talking like a century, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, go back a century and then another century, right? You're talking about like your great, 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 you know, we're not that far removed from.
We're really not. Oh my gosh. I shared some meme on Instagram the other day, and it said something like, consider this, the number of years between now and 1980 is the same number of years between 1980 and 1939.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. You just made me feel old.
Right? Like, first you feel old, and then you go, geez, it was not that long ago.
Right.
Yeah. That World War II, civil rights, all of these things, they feel so remote if they happened before your birth.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. If they happened before your birth. But, you know, your parents, we're not far removed from this stuff. It still affects us every day, and knowledge is proprietary. And I'll give you an example at home. So I have a son who, he has an older sister, and she basically helped him to learn his letters and sounds. And as a result, he was reading like an adult when he was 3 and a half. Right. So I decide, let me try mathematics. And so he completes Algebra 1 at the age of 7, Algebra 2 and trig at 9, all right? Starts doing calculus at 10. So at some point, my mother says to me, when he was like 5 or so, I think he's smarter than you. And my response was, no the hell he ain't. His daddy got a PhD in physics. My daddy dropped out of school when he was 9 years old, right? It makes a big difference. Knowledge is proprietary. If it's not in the house, how are you going to get it? Right? When I said earlier about either it has to be in your home or your family, or you're lucky, I say that to say, as a scientist, right, the pathway to get here is through academics. So teachers are going to be the people that are training you for college in a way, right? Now, let's look at coaches versus teachers.
Okay.
If I am a high school athlete, what is the probability that my coach did sports at a high level? And so for me, in my definition of a high level, if you played sports in college, that's a pretty high level, right?
For sure.
I think that the probability is like 50-50, right? Even in my little high school, the Heidelberg, Mississippi, right? We had coaches that played college ball. Now, what's the probability that your science or math teacher actually worked as a professional scientist or engineer?
Oh, very low.
Damn near, it has to be less than 10%.
Yeah, right? Not until college, which, are you going to go to college and are you going to major in one of these fields? We're talking about that pipeline starting early. You're right. Yeah. High school, in middle school, hell no. Like maybe we're lucky enough that they have a degree in that subject, but they might just have a general education degree.
Yeah, or they have a degree in that subject, but still doing physics as an undergrad isn't the same thing as playing college football, right?
For sure. The
equivalent to me would be getting a graduate degree in a topic, right? So if you got a PhD in chemistry or physics, that's like the equivalent of playing college ball, right? You're damn near professional, and there's one more step, right?
Yeah, you've got elite training.
Yeah, you got elite training. But the point I'm making is that how can a high school teacher who's teaching math and physics prepare future physicists when they don't even know what that is, right? And I'll give you an example of that. There is the classic statement of the misguided student trying to learn math. They say, when will I ever need this? When will I ever use this in my life, right? Well, you know what I learned? There's something to that. When you actually look at the math that's taught and the math that's actually done as a professional engineer, scientist, for the most part, all you really need to do as far as numbers are concerned is add and multiply the single digit numbers most of the time, right? You're doing stuff like x squared times x cubed, right? And you ask somebody on the street, what's x squared plus times x cubed? They'll look at you like you're crazy, most people, right? You ask them what's plus 3, they'll say 5, right? And it's the exact same problem. But, I say all this to say that, if you grow up with me in your house, you get those things and you get them very young. And so by the time you reach college, you've already seen it several times. Compare that with me, who had my parents, right? When I'm getting to college, I'm seeing things for the first time. And not only that, the way I've been educated, it makes it harder for me to learn the real way than if I had been educated properly from the start. You know, it's you have to unlearn things to learn things the right way sometimes.
Right. We're not walking around with empty minds. We're walking around with minds that, you know, are filled with procedures and heuristics that fit our kind of frame and our worldview. And sometimes those things are actually, yeah, they negatively impact us in other areas. Like you take a fish and you put a fish out of the water and into the tank, or vice versa. And all of a sudden, a lot of the skills that were developed to help navigate that one world do not work in this new world.
Yeah. And, you know, that is classic. When I was first started professoring, you know, I would ask my fellow professors, why don't we just teach the students all the professional ways from day one? Like, I'll give you an example. If you're going to be a scientist or engineer, you have to write up these professional reports. And to do that, you mostly use a software called LaTeX or LaTeX. And so why do we have them do this college book or a lab report format that is never used anywhere else in life?
I know, yeah.
Teach them to do it the professional way from day one.
True. Yeah. Why are we so often learning how to do it the way we're going to do it in industry or in academia once we get there, as opposed to, yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. Like adjusting the frame. And I think one thing to kind of go back to is when you mentioned being in Stanford and realizing, A, these people are not intrinsically smarter. B, they definitely don't work harder. I feel like there's this C to this, which is that they have so many more resources.
Oh, absolutely.
They had parents at home where it was never a question. It was actually an expectation that they were going to go to Stanford.
Well, let me tell you another quick couple of stories. So mm-hmm. I was talking to my PhD advisor. So my daughter, her name is Camila. She was born when I was in grad school. And they had married with students housing, right? And so we lived in that. And I noticed that, you know, there were a lot of families where one parent just stayed home watching the kids and the other parent was a student. So I asked my PhD, I'm like, how do they do that? You know, how is that possible? And he goes, oh, their parents helped them. And to me, the thought never even crossed my mind.
You're like, they must have a money well. Like, what? There's like, no other way.
Like, where I come from, you help your parents.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. When you become an adult, they don't help you. You know?
Right. They bust their ass the whole time you were a kid to keep food on the table and to do all these things so that when you have earning potential, you're going to start giving back.
Well, it's not necessarily so that. Right. You take care of each other, you know.
Right, that's right.
It's sort of like when I started working in Africa. You know, they saw America as being so rich and luxurious, which it is, but they were like, "So how is it you have homeless people and we don't?"
Yeah.
And the difference is that their family takes care of them, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what you do when you're, less well off financially. But there's so many different ways that these differences, you know, show up in academia, you know. So when you read my book, you know, you'll see one of the things is that people can just be explicitly mean to you. You're right. You know, not are they being mean to me? You know, not questionable. They'll be like, dude, beat it. We don't like you. We don't want you here. You know, not
right. It's not the microaggressions. These are like just macroaggressions. These are just obvious. Yeah.
The younger people are, right, the more likely they are to engage in such behavior. So, you know, once we get a little older, we become respectful and these things. But, you know, the youth will be blunt about it.
And there's this thing that ends up happening, which is obviously a perpetual cycle of discrimination based on, you know, based on slavery first, then based on Jim Crow, based on redlining, based on all of these issues where you have segmentation, compartmentalization of neighborhoods, whole societies. And then there becomes a central economy because there's a lack of access to the kind of larger economy. And, you know, the means of making money are different in these neighborhoods and the goals and priorities are different. And then ultimately, what ends up happening as a side effect of that is that for a young kid growing up in a neighborhood that actually does have a tendency and an interest in academics, you almost have to hide that side of yourself for fear of being bullied or, like, it's not cool in certain neighborhoods.
You know, I'll tell you, for me, you know, I had the experience of being a city boy and a country boy.
Okay? Right. Yeah.
And what you just described, I experienced in cities.
Right. And I'm coming from LA, kind of giving that perspective for sure.
Yeah, I experienced that in LA.
Yeah.
Houston and in New Orleans. But in Mississippi, oh man, it was almost like, you know, I was the people's champion, right?
Oh,
like,
really? Cool. I love that.
Academic contest, and they celebrated it, you know, and it was like that for everyone. And I'll give you another example to illustrate the support of certain parts of academia in the Black community that might be more reachable for people. If you have ever watched Amateur Night at the Apollo back in the day, at the end, they would have what they call the kids competition. And the hostess was a woman named Kiki Shepherd. And she would ask the child, what's your favorite subject in school all the time, right? Every kid. If a kid said mathematics or a science, the audience would just erupt. Yeah, right? Because they know. So yeah, other kids will bully you because you're getting attention from the teacher and that sort of thing. But, you know, there's all these people, especially the adults, who are so supportive of you, right? Because of they value that.
Yeah. And so I'm interested in you personally. When you were young, how readily did you find that in yourself? How much did you feed it? How much did you try to suppress it? Like how was that identity development going for you? And sort of when did you know?
Yeah. So what happened with me is it's a strange thing how it worked out for me. But my pathway to an intellectual identity was books. So my mother was a reader. And I remember when she was 7 years old, she bought me like two or three little books, but they had my name in it, my sister's name, and my best friend's name in it, right? And so I just loved reading those books. And at the same time, I became really excited about the natural world, right? From watching TV shows, Marty Stoffer, Wild America, Jacques Cousteau, right? That's what I was into. Well, it turns out that my mother's best friend had a son who was 2 years older than me. This guy grows up to be the second highest ranked African-American in the U.S. Navy submarine fleet and ultimately ends up running the base at Ames Station in San Jose. NASA Ames there? Yeah. Darren Brown is his name. And Darren and I sort of together had intellectual kid identity developed. And so, you know, when I was 8 years old, for example, Darren taught me chess and we would play chess all the time. And so, you know, after many, many years, you know, we separated after high school. We went about our separate lives and we reunited in 2010. I was in the Bay Area and, you know, we met up and I said, hey, man, you know, I just want to let you know I made you famous, bruh, because I've been telling a story about you all these years. And I always credit you with the person who gave me the identity of being a smart guy. And what he says to me blows me away. He goes, well, you know what? We inspired each other because before you showed up, it wasn't cool to be like that, right? But then you made it okay for me to be like that, right? And so, yeah. And so I had sort of an ambassador to introduce me to that way of thinking. And at the same time, you know, I had a single mom who worked all the time. I was left alone a lot. And my first experiences with humans involved a lot of violence, right? So I've never been that fun. You know, humans, you know, got a love-hate relationship with them, right? My greatest source of joy, my greatest source of pain. But, you know, I was going to title the first chapter of the book, It Ain't Safe, Meet the Humans. So, you know, I found myself bonding with books at a young age, and that's kind of what led me to being, you know, the identity that ultimately developed. Like when I was a student, you know, I get my school books and I just devour them in the first 2 weeks and never need them again. Right. It's in my head now. And you know, you're right. That didn't go over too well with my fellow students. Right. The guy who has every answer, you know,
right,
he doesn't put out any effort. But
and who the teacher is like really giving a lot of attention to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, as a matter of fact, I was in the New Orleans Ninth Ward attendance school, which is, you know, where the Desire Projects are. And we had an election for class president and nobody nominated me. So the teacher kind of dropped the hint for someone to nominate me, you know, the best student. And they did. And guess what? I ended up getting one vote. My own.
Gosh.
Now, don't think, you know, like for the most of my life, I've been super popular, right? In high school, college, and beyond, I'm always like a popular guy. So don't think, it was a life of loneliness. It's not that, right?
You felt good when you were so little.
Right. It was horrible. Yeah. Like, oh, no. Yeah.
And, you know, so many things come up for me based on, you know, some of what you were just sharing. The first thing is this idea about books and this idea that, you know, there's no way to know. And there's nothing to say that if you just give books to kids, all kids are going to become academics. It's just not true. Some kids are never going to go that route. But the truth is, how would we know if the kids don't ever have that kind of access? And it takes more than just having books in your home, even though that is definitely a start, because I bet you a lot of those kids that were bullying you for that didn't have books when they were young. There just weren't books in their home. But also to see a mom who's constantly reading and to go, I want to be like mom, or to have a mom who reads to you before you go to sleep. These things are so important. And the other thing kind of sticks out to me is when you were talking about your friend who ended up at Ames, this idea that culture, it's such a funny thing because in many ways culture happens to us and it exists as a collective that feels so much bigger than us and so much more powerful than us. And we sort of are swept away by the tides of culture. But at the same time, culture is co-created, and you and him created a culture together that normalized and allowed you to be yourselves. And you may not have had that if you hadn't found another kid to cope with that with.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another aspect of it was, and, you know, this is one that's tough, but I know it's the truth. I was lonely. And by being alone, I was like, what am I going to do? And, you know, it became, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll play with flammables and sharp objects. You know, I was in the country, right? So I could, you know, like, I kid you not. I love playing with fire. And, you know, we had gasoline, kerosene, and gunpowder, right? Because people would make their own shells. And we hunted and all that kind of jazz, right? But let me tell you something I would do in high school. I would take the gunpowder out of a shotgun shell, you know? And roll it up in a rolling paper, because, you know, a lot of people would roll their own cigarettes, Prince Albert. And I put a little parsley on each end and then go to school and hand it to a guy and he thinks it's a joint. And I'd be like, yo, fire it up. Oh, my goodness. Do not do that. Do not repeat this experiment. I was young and dumb.
It's so funny, though, but it's also so profound, this idea that, like, And this isn't always the case, but like there's like the little weird kid who's maybe doing some things that seem dangerous and uncouth and you're a little concerned. And it's like, I wonder if you could just channel that kid who is like making a bomb in his garage. Like, wait, maybe he just really wants to take a chemistry class.
Yeah. You know, what happened in my case was, you know, in middle school, all the boys, their last two periods was football. Right. in the spring. And so I going out for football and we didn't have enough helmets to go around. And somebody stole my helmet. So that was it. I was no longer showing up for football. And so what I was doing is what we call running the halls. And I would also like pretend to smoke cigarettes, like pretend, because to this day, like tobacco smoke, I can't inhale it at all. If somebody's smoking a cigarette 20 feet away from me, it like chokes me up. Right. So I would just like suck it into my mouth and blow it out. But my assistant principal caught me. He was like, nah, dude, we're going to do something with you. And he turned me over to the school's other disciplinarian who happened to be our band director. And he was like, do something with this boy before we have to do something with this boy. And that changed my life, you know, because music became one of those big things in my world, right? In my little, you know, childhood world.
And I think that's the part that's probably equivalently frustrating for teachers and parents who actually have the time and the energy to put in to kids. But also it can be the part that's so fulfilling is not every kid is going to take to math. Not every kid is going to take to music. Not every kid is going to take to you need those options.
You know, I think, though, it starts before the subject, right? I think it starts.
Yeah.
And, you know, you never know. Like, I'll give you an example. When I was in grad school, you know, I taught classes as a graduate student, but it wasn't like having my own class. So when I went to Silicon Valley, I decided to teach a nighttime astronomy class at the local junior college. Okay. And, you know, I have a personality such that, you know, I like to help people and listen and this sort of thing. And, you know, and it got me in trouble because, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I don't know, you know, people come with like horror stories. What do you do? Right. But come with horror stories, they did. And, you know, it was eye-opening for me because you don't know what people are going through. And the reason why I bring this up is because teachers have so much power. Some fellow teachers say things that will be, you know, the opposite of motivating the students, right? And if you can be that positive force, that motivating force, if you can be the person that says, oh, I'm interested in you. So for example, when I was in the, when I first started doing extracurricular activities, it wasn't when I got to Mississippi. It was just before that when I was in Houston. So I lived in a community known as South Park, which, you know, the hood. And I took the bus into the Third Ward to attend James Ryan High Middle School, right? Which is near Yates High School. And that was the hood too. But now it's been gentrified, so it's no longer the hood. It's now a medical campus. When those teachers saw me, right, those teachers were like, oh, my God, look at this kid's performance. They were like, okay, I'm going to put you in the drama club, my English teacher did. I'm going to put you in the math club, my math teacher did. And I signed up for the swim team. And it was, you know, through extracurricular activities, being drawn into them by teachers, that I got to be able to compete outside of my school to see that, oh, I'm competitive when I try, right? And that, you know, establishing that identity was really important for me going forward, right? To do extracurricular activities once I did settle down in Mississippi.
And the interesting thing is it actually really contributes to the resiliency because you're now a multifaceted human being with multiple interests. So as you get older and you say, maybe I want to go to college and maybe you try on a major and it doesn't quite fit, you're not just going to give up. You're going to say, that's okay. I have other things to offer and I have other interests.
Well, let me tell you something else about Mississippi. They, at least back in the day, you have to work from the time. Once you hit like 7 years old, you're working, right? You're working on the farm, in the fields, you're working in the woods. And where I was living, it was hauling pulpwood. And if you don't know what that is, good for you. Because let me tell you, it is hard and dirty work. But I went out there and, you know, I was a city boy out in the woods. And I could not believe how hard they were making us work. And there was like zero sympathy.
Yeah. You know, it was yeah.
So, you know, I'm carrying a tuba through the Mississippi heat, right? And then go to military and boot camp. And then I go to a program run by the Marine Corps, you know. So by the time I get to college, talk about grit and resilience and know how to work hard, right?
Yeah.
That's what carried me through was the fact that I, you know, that's another thing you learn by growing up American poor. And you don't I didn't realize this till I was very old, but the extent to which you learn to ignore pain, right? Because you don't go to the doctor. So for example, the week I got out of the Navy in 1986, I broke my shoulder. All right. Guess when I went to the doctor for it? 1993.
Yeah, not good.
Yeah. I was in grad school, which was the second time in my life after being in the Navy when I had health insurance. And, you know, after being in there for a year, I realized, oh, health insurance means I can go to the doctor. Maybe I can get this. I should get this shoulder looked at, by which time I needed a full shoulder reconstruction surgery. Right.
It's a big problem it's one of those things that like we just don't get as Americans, having this like crappy healthcare system that is very preferential towards, you know,
and people,
wealth and whiteness
of identity, you know, whether it's the economic, the racial, and what happens to you, you know, as a result. Like, I'll give you another example. You know, like when you're there are certain things you don't know unless you know, right? So one of them I like to always ask people is the following. Suppose you go several days without eating, and then you take a bite of food. What happens inside your mouth?
Oh, inside your mouth?
Yeah, just to make it easier. Yeah, you don't know, because it catches you by surprise.
I guess you make a lot of saliva. I don't know.
Your what mouth happens? Fills with pain.
Oh, it's like pain.
Kind of like crazy mode where it's like the whole volume of your mouth face just hurts, right? It's like, what the hell is that? So I Googled it recently, and it does have something to do with saliva glands.
Yeah.
But like, you don't know that unless you experience that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of
days. Yeah.
Yeah. So you add all these things up. You know, that's what's so good about my book, is that you get to see all, you know, there's so much that you're like, how does anyone make it out of this situation.
Exactly. And I think that brings up one other thing for me. As you were talking about working as a professor and kids coming to you and revealing their horror stories and their pain, and through your book, telling about your own personal horror stories and your pain. And I think one of the things that really, I don't know, comes up for me is this idea of frame and of reference, just like you were talking about with, if you haven't eaten and people are like, I don't know, I eat every day. I remember when I was working, I worked in foster care for a few years as part of my training in a group home setting. So I was, you know, hearing many of these horror stories that you talked about. It was my population of patients was, they were all girls, kind of preteen, adolescent, preteen and teenage girls. Many of them had been trafficked. Many of them had like pretty violent abuse and neglect histories. And one of the things that really resonated for me, and I feel like we all get this intellectually, but once you really get it emotionally, so many things fall into place for you, is that kids who are violently and horrifically abused in the home when they're young don't know that that's not normal, because that's their frame. And it takes a while to, once they enter into the greater world, to understand options, to understand that that's not everybody else's frame. And I think we say this, we see the same thing with poverty, with class divides, with race divides. If we keep people segmented and they don't have a seat at the table, they don't know that that seat even exists.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I'll give you another, a good example of what you just described. So I used to do this television show called Outrageous Acts of Science.
Yeah. And
we would frequently stay in this hotel, the Sheraton Universal.
Oh my gosh, you must know Karen Bondar.
Yeah, I know Karen.
She's a good friend.
Oh my God.
That's so funny.
Yeah. On my Instagram.
I love it.
Everybody loves Karen. Karen's
yeah,
like,
I know. Who doesn't love Karen?
So, yeah. But anyway, I can tell you how many times I'm in that damn hotel and the elevator opens and it's a woman and her children, and the children start getting on the elevator and the mom stops them, bloop, and they let the doors close, they catch another one. Like, not with him. Like, I'm the nicest guy in the world, right? Or even like when I was in Boston, like, this is the one I didn't get. I was taking the train everywhere. People wouldn't even sit next to me. And I'm like, why is it there's no seats and no one will sit? You know, I don't smell. I'm a decent looking guy. What, you know, what is it? There's all these microaggressions that occur that people are just completely unaware of. And it's, there's nothing you can do, you know, being nice, being, you know, you have to do this. Like, for example, do you know a woman named Jarita Holbrook? Okay. So she's an amazing woman. She speaks like six languages. She's a black woman, grew up in LA, got her undergraduate degree at Caltech in physics, went to UC Santa Cruz to do astronomy, but then decided, I hate this field, or at least the people in the field, so let me study the people in the field, right? And so she started what's called cultural astronomy and also making movies. And so she did, I'm in a couple of her documentaries. But Jarita said this to me one day. She goes, Hakeem, this was years and years ago, like a decade ago. She goes, Hakeem, have you noticed that among the black men that have had successful careers in astronomy, they're all either short of stature or have a high-pitched voice. And most of them have both, right? And, you know, I did a quick little, wow, you're right, except for me, right? And she goes, yeah, the only reason why you made it is because you're goofy.
What?
Yeah, and what she means by that, you know, in later years, she says that, well, you know, Hakeem has this self-deprecating humor that puts people at ease. And the reason why
I see that you're not scaring people, you're not confrontating. Right.
And it's something that you do, just like code switching.
Yep.
You do, okay, let me make sure no one is feels threatened by me, right? That's something else you have to do.
I'm like, a safe black man.
That's
Yeah.
And especially if I have a nice white woman to vouch for you. Oh, now you're golden, right?
Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
It's a complicated world we live in. And, you know, people are complicated. And so one of the things I dislike about conversations about race is that we do sometimes say, you know, white, black, right? And, you know, at a certain point, I learned that people are all individuals, you know, and honestly, at the age of 24, when I left Mississippi to go to graduate school at Stanford, I was of the mind, all white people are racist, right? As far as my experience at that point. Then I come to, but here's another point I like to make is that, you know, when you're subject to people mistreating you for whatever reason, you know, you sort of develop a radar so that you can avoid it, right? So I kind of develop racist radar, right? So one of the things that triggers that is people who talk to you like they're superior to you. Well, guess what happens in academia a lot? Especially, right? Yeah. So it took me a while to realize, oh, you're not a racist. You're just an asshole.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. You talk to everyone like you're superior to them.
Exactly, right? And also, all skin folk ain't kin folk, right?
Yeah.
If I look at who's pulled out guns on me, I've had guns pulled out on me in racist incidents. I've had guns pulled out on me unnecessarily by police. But by far, it's black dudes who's pulling the most guns on me, right? So, you know, it's a complicated situation. And the best thing we can do is all interact and get to know each other as individuals, right? Not this group. And you know, I saw a study some years ago about attitudes about Mexican-Americans. And what they found was that, you know, on the southern border, attitudes were, oh yeah, we love Mexican people, right? And the farther you moved away, the more the hostility increased, right?
Right. It's all about exposure. It's all about your communities mixing together. It's about
humans are humans.
Yeah. And it's about intersectionality. When you only have a single identity.
Oh boy.
It becomes a lot harder to have multiple tribes or to move outside or beyond the tribe. But when you have lots of interests, lots of identities, then you have, you know, I've got my gay friends over here and I've got my, you know, my friends over here who are like my music people and I've got my friends over here who are my academic people. Yeah, exactly. And then you start to learn the rules and the exceptions to the rules and you start to learn. Yeah.
And you know, you bring up a good point because everybody, whatever group you're in, if it is attacked for some particular reason, right, you know all those stereotypes of all those attacks that go against you. But other people may not. Like there was like one that happened recently. There was a guy who made a Jewish slur, a basketball player, this center for Miami Heat, while playing a video game, right? I'm not going to say the word, but I knew that word. But what I did not know was that it was a Jewish slur. I thought it was a German, you know, some thing to do with World War II. Right? You know how in wars you refer to the enemy with flattering term. That's what I thought it was. I thought it was a non-flattering term for Germans during the German, you know. Another example of that, I was watching America's Next Top Model back in the day. And there was an African-American woman who was raised among white people. So she was unaware of the standard stereotypes. So they're all on the bus and they were given, you know, they rolled together on a bus and they were given their headshots. And so this one woman says in front of everybody, the white people, right? She goes, "I look like a monkey." So the other black girls are like, "What the hell?" You know, But here's the point though. If you're aware of like that whole thing of, "Oh, you're not a racist, you're just an asshole."
Yeah.
A person behaving the same way, if you think they're just being a jerk versus being racist, it impacts you differently.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Your entire frame of reference is different.
Yeah. So imagine if you are unaware of, suppose somebody comes up to me and calls me the N-word and I don't even know that that's an insult. In fact, I think it's a compliment. And I'm like, "Thank you." Right. Like, what's the better position to be? Getting hurt or being, you know, oblivious to it? So if you know the other person's intention, right, or you know the story that's in their mind, then you're affected psychologically. So let me give you an example of something I used to do. I lived in Huntsville, Alabama. I was at the university there in NASA, and I would drive cross country to California, across northern Alabama, northern Mississippi, Louisiana. And, you know, these are some places that, you know, if you're living in small towns, sometimes in the South, you have like the white store and the black store type thing. Like my time was like that. And if you're black and you stop at the white store, you know it when you walk in, right? There's a reaction. And so it's not violence typically, it's people just go silent and look at you until you leave, right? So I did this trick. I noticed that when I'm in another country and I'm unaware of the stories in their heads and their assumptions, I don't feel those kind of, that pressure is relieved, right? That weight is off my shoulders. So I'm like, "Oh, I'll just pretend I'm in a foreign country." Now I'm unaffected by your attitudes.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, I used to, it's funny because I used to see this with a lot of the girls in the group home too, this idea that there was a lot of fights and a lot of conflict about looking at each other. This was a core source of, "Well, she looked at me. She looked at me funny. She looked at me that way." And there was always a lot of reason. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was always a lot of work, therapeutic work on reframing, like, because the core assumption is that there's something there. And a lot of times there probably is, but many times there absolutely isn't. And the question is, you know, are we going to carry that weight of making assumptions about why they looked at me, what their judgments are, what they're trying, they want to fight, they're fronting, they're whatever.
I understand this too, okay? Your expectations are based on your experiences.
Absolutely.
So I was such a defensive being until damn near the age of 30. Because remember, my intro to planet Earth and the humans was, it ain't safe.
Exactly. They're out to get me.
Yeah. And because they are, you are getting hit and punched and ridiculed and humiliated all day, every day. Right. So that's your expectation. So if someone mean mugs you, like, listen, I had so many fights. My son, when he was in middle school, I asked him, "How many fights have you had?" He was like, "None." If I had not had a couple hundred fights by the time, you know, and why did I have a lot? I would play basketball a lot in my 20s. And guys have arguments, you know, they'll stand faces inches from each other just arguing, right? I was always incapable of that because I had experienced so much violence that I pretty much had three modes: normal, silent, and I'm punching you in the face.
Right.
Why am I punching you in the face? Because I am afraid. So it's much better that I punch you in the face first than you punch me.
You want to neutralize the threat. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so that's how I live my life. For a long time, seeing everyone as a threat.
Yeah. And you're right.
These
girls very often did that too. And, you know, it was like a lot of very difficult reframing, working on the idea that, like, yes, there are threats. And yes, certain people in these situations are out to get you, but not everybody and not in other situations.
It's easy to say that, but then they go home.
Exactly. Right? But then, well, and sadly, these girls, we were their home. But yeah, I mean, we got them out of that home. But there is that difficulty. And I think you see it in a lot of the racial history. I mean, this is kind of a total aside, which we'll come back and we'll wrap things up. But I was just mentioning this on the other podcast I work on, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
So you got to get me on that one too. I'm such
Hell yeah. Oh, God, I love it.
You know, so this summer, you know, the news networks made me sort of the Dr. Fauci of the UFO UAP thing.
Oh God. We got to get you on that.
But from the skeptical side. So yeah,
exactly. Oh, that's great.
Man, people didn't like that.
No, they never do. I know. We're always the bad guy.
Oh, man. I was like, I mean, and you know, where people went with it. They're like, oh, he's a CIA, whatever. And I'm like, what? Are you getting that?
Yeah, always. Yeah, you're always some sort of shill or some sort of operative. And
I'm the man now.
You know, yeah, you're the man or no. But yeah, we were talking on the show and one of the co-hosts was asking, I think it might have even been off air, but he was asking about a new study about IQ and like somebody was reviving the race and IQ argument. And I was like, you know, there's a lot of problems with IQ tests, like, you know, from a psychometric theory standpoint, a lot of these were developed by known eugenicists with an express directive of trying to prove superiority of whiteness. And so even though we've in many ways gotten away from that and done a lot of really good work to try to change the norm reference tables and things like that, there's obviously massive undercurrents and traces. And one thing that I was trying to explain was there's a test. It's not an IQ test. It's called the MMPI. It's a test of actually personality and a lot of other things. It's a very old test, but it's been iterated a lot and has like some of the most literature and research ever done on it. But there are certain scales that are loaded and they are legit. They come across, I don't even know how to put this, they have racist outcomes simply because, like, oftentimes here in America, Black individuals will load high on paranoia on these scales. And so people will assess them as having more psychopathology and having more, you know, potential psychosis, when really, if you look at the questions, they say things like, the police are out to get me.
Oh my God. Well, that's...
And you're like... Of course they are, you know, and it's one of those things that if only white people are writing the tests and if only white, it's just like if you've never had the experience and you've never opened that frame there. And how do we change that? It's not that, yes, it helps. Reading your book helps. Opening up my perspective and my mind helps. But you have to have a seat at the table. You have to also be writing the test.
And you know what? That's why I appreciate you for having me on today. Because, you know, in academia, I feel like people like me are often swept under the table. And what do I mean, people like me? People who have the lived experience of being at the very bottom. You know, I think that there is sort of like a bourgeoisie in academia.
Absolutely.
And so they're like, okay, you have skin that is consistent with having the experiences of this race, but then you find out that in fact, you know, that's not their experience.
They're from yeah.
And I see a lot of that. I'm just like, why won't they give the microphone to someone who's actually, you know, sold a dime bag here and there? You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, humor. You know, why they won't do it oftentimes. I think they're scared of what you're going to say.
Yeah, and I feel like people talk to people that they feel comfortable with.
Exactly.
Right? And those people are the ones who reflect them in a way.
You're so right. And I think that the whole point of this is that I've been really working to change the narrative of my show. It's not just about science, but science happens, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens in a cultural context. And so as much as, like, thank you for thanking me for having you on, I want to say to you, thank you for coming on. And I cannot imagine that it's easy to tell your story over and over and over and over. And I cannot imagine that it feels good when people are like, what's it like to be a Black scientist?
Well, that last part I don't care about, right? I find like people are super sensitive now, you know?
Okay, yeah. And
there's a lot of diversity in the diversity, right? Some people, like I heard somebody write on Twitter, an athlete, how they got angry because a reporter asked him, is your parent still alive? And, you know, I've asked people that. A lot of people have asked me that. It's sort of like, you know, when you're an adult, it's almost, you know.
Yeah, true, actually. Yeah.
Okay, now let's, you know, let's continue the conversation. another thing I want to say is that, you know, to the extent that someone who does have the lived experience does get the opportunity, you know, I think that for those people that are coming up that either have a similar experience or are on the path to considering the you know, I feel like the conversation can stay more real, right? So, you know, you bring up a topic and I'm like, oh, let me give you like 12 life examples.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Not some abstract thing that the literature said, right?
You're so right. Yeah, like this is how that manifests for me. And then somebody listening is like, holy shit, now that's either I feel that too, because I've been there, which I think is so important. Or for those who are listening who never have and who, you know, hopefully it opens up that sort of perspective a little bit. You know, Hakeem, before we wrap it up and go, and I know that we didn't dive that deep into like all of the stories, but I don't tend to like to, I like to talk around people's books because the whole point is like, read the damn book, people. Like, I don't want to tell you everything that's in the book. But before we go, I was hoping that you would answer me two questions that I close every episode with. You know, I'm always interested in people's perspectives because they come from different places and different interest levels. And so these are big picture questions. I'm wondering, when you're thinking about the future and in whatever context is relevant, so it could be the future of like planet Earth, the future of American society, the future of, as a cosmologist, of like, you know, the universe, the cosmos, or even you personally, your life, your journey. Number one, what is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night that you're concerned about, that there's like some pessimism, maybe even some cynicism about? But then on the flip side of that, where do you find genuine, authentic hope? What are you optimistic about?
So the first one, you know, I've never been cynical, but then now I'm a bit cynical.
Okay.
About the future. And what has done that for me is the loss of biodiversity that I personally have witnessed. Little simple things like, where did the butterflies go?
Yeah. Or the lightning bugs. I don't see them anymore.
Yeah. Or the, you know, anytime I'll pass still water, you know, in a ditch on the side of the road, I see frog eggs and I don't see that anymore. Right. I don't see the frog eggs clustered everywhere anymore. I went home to Mississippi a couple of years ago before the pandemic, went to my old community and, you know, the places where there were fruits and berries and nut trees, they're not there. You know, I talked to a friend who still lives there. He's like, yeah, man, you know, all those pecan trees that were everywhere, they're not anywhere. The apple trees are gone. The plum trees are gone. And I can only assume that that's due to a loss of pollinators. I don't know why that would be the case. But I just wonder, you know, I don't know that a planet that's the only living things or things that humans use is viable. I don't know that it's not viable. But I feel like that's not a good formula.
God, what a good way to put that. Yeah, if it doesn't serve me, I don't care about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of, you know, how we're treating the other life forms on the planet, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now,
for hope, you know, it's the human potential for me. I see so much potential in humanity, right? If we were trusting, if we were trustworthy, we could be Star Trek tomorrow. But you know, the people who rise to the top of our political classes, you know, don't always seem to, you know, it seems to be about power and greed dynamics quite often, more so than service, what's best for the nation, what's best for the people. And you know, I'll give you, you know, another example. I would love to see humanity as a whole come together. You know, we've had three atmospheric emergencies, global warming, acid rain, the hole in the ozone layer, right? What that says to me is, oh, we can engineer our atmosphere,
yeah. Right? Yeah.
Going into an international treaty to do that, we're like, oh, let's go for all the money we can. Oops, we created a crisis. Now let's fix the crisis or pretend it doesn't exist. right? So anyway, I don't know what I was going for with that. I forgot what train of thought.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it is the human potential. It is the idea. And I think that ultimately, you know, in reading your book, in talking to you, really strikes me as you know, the legacy of Dr. Hakeem Olusheyi, which is that not only, you know, is it the patents and the innovations and the discoveries about our cosmos, about our galaxy, about our sun, but it's the people that you've inspired and that you've shown there is a path for you. It's okay. You can be you. Your skills and your strengths are valuable. We want them. And that there will be kids who didn't think they could, but somewhere in their heart of hearts wanted to try, that now know they can and that they're not alone. And I mean, good God, is that not important? And we will not see kids go into these fields unless they see people who look like them, who sound like them, who remind them of their home doing those things. Otherwise, they do not realize that it's even an option.
Exactly.
And you're doing that. And I thank you for that. And I thank you for joining us today and for sharing your story.
Yes. Thank you so much. It's been a joy. I hope to talk to you again.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, we will. Everybody, the book is A Quantum Life, My Unlikely Journey from the Street to the Stars. Collectively, we're going to thank Dr. Hakeem Olusheyi and, of course, his co-author, Joshua Horwitz. And thank you, everybody, for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk.